I invite you to open your Bible this morning with me to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 8 is where we are, Matthew 8, 18 through 22. I was tempted to go further, but I thought, no, we'll just handle this section as a separate section. It's short, and it's a section we can easily handle, but it deserves attention, not just being passed over quickly. Section we're going to look at today, 18 through 20, falls between the miracles that we talked about last week, but then Jesus performing more miracles, calming a storm, and then healing two men possessed of demons, casting out those demons. So Matthew 8, verse 18 is where we begin. Now when Jesus saw a great crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. And a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead." This is God's holy, inspired, and infallible word. May he add his blessing to its reading. I suppose that most of us know this phrase that I'm going to use, and we've perhaps even used it ourselves. Sometimes we'll use a term, a colloquial phrase. This will separate the men from the boys. And what does that phrase mean? What is it trying to communicate? It's basically saying something is facing this group of people, and we're going to see how they respond. Do they have the skill to overcome the barriers that are there, the complexities? Do they have the perseverance or the commitment to see it through to the end? And of course, the terminology, men versus boys, is that those who persevere really are mature, and those who don't see it through or fall by the wayside maybe aren't as mature. So it's not really a judgmental thing, it's just a colloquial term, separate the men from the boys, those who are mature from those who are not mature enough or are not skilled enough. As an aside, a bit of humor here as well. Years ago, on listening to a Prairie Home Companion with Garrison Keillor on public radio, they had a similar thing, separating the men from the boys. And they had a fictional advertiser on the program. It was for a company that made cereal, a cereal called Raw Bits. And it wasn't just for anyone. It really was separating the men from the boys. It was comprised of oat hulls and wheat chaff. Those were the main ingredients to the cereal. Of course, there's no nutritional value in that, and that's the whole point. It's a spoof. But you just couldn't go to the store and buy it. You had to apply for it. You had to fill out an application. You had to send in references and everything else. Only certain people were qualified to get it. Are you tough enough to handle raw bits? So as we come to this passage, there's a bit of winnowing going on, sifting, separating the wheat from the chaff, if you will, as Jesus is probing the sincerity of the hearts of those who are gathering around him. And as he does this, he's not only challenging the people in the text, he's challenging us. And I hope you realize that really the questions are pointed at you and me. Are we really truly following Jesus as a disciple, or we're merely simply a follower, kind of a person looking on and observing? We begin with the first person. Exhibit A is a scribe. And we're told in verse 18 that a great crowd had gathered around Jesus. The crowd had gathered because of what took place immediately before this. In verse 14, Jesus entered Peter's house and healed his mother-in-law. And at evening that night, presumably this was the Sabbath, and at evening when the Sabbath came to an end, all sorts of people were brought to him. People oppressed by demons, he cast out the spirits with the word, healed all who were sick. I take it the passage to mean now it's that the very next day is at hand, and people are up at the crack of dawn, even more people gathering around him, wanting more miracles, wanting more signs, wanting more from him. He sees the crowd and he realizes They've gathered, but they've come with wrong motives. They didn't gather to hear him preach and teach. They've gathered to see a miracle. They've gathered to see a sign. They've gathered to see what else he can do. At this point, he gives orders to go over to the other side. Capernaum, again, is on the northwest portion of the Sea of Galilee. They're going to get in the boats and they're going to sail. They're going to go across to the east somewhere to get some peace and quiet, to get some space from the crowds. So he gives an order. They begin to move towards the boats, is the way I understand the passage to read. And a scribe approaches Jesus and says to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." I suppose this is as good a time as any to talk about a scribe and what they did and who they were. One writer, and it's unclear, you know, you read about the scribes and the Pharisees in the New Testament, and it's unclear, well, what exactly do they do? One writer explains that the role of the scribe began simply as an administrative position all the way back in 1 Chronicles 27. Ezra himself, it's a book in the Bible named after him, is described as a scribe in Nehemiah 8. Scribes were initially used to copy manuscripts and to compose official documents. But over time, those who were scribes, it morphed into an official position and an institution in the nation. And by Jesus's times, by the time of Jesus's ministry, scribes were teachers, scholars, lecturers, and copiers all rolled into one. So they're scholars. They're like experts in the law. They handle all the official documents, all the manuscripts. They're teachers. They're like professors. They're at the top, so to speak. This person comes to Jesus. "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." The word teacher here is a term of respect. He doesn't ascribe to Jesus anything about deity. He's not worshiping Jesus at this point. He just recognizes Jesus' ability to teach. He says, "I will follow you wherever you go." How sincere is his desire to follow Jesus? There's a range here. The term is kind of elastic. It could be just simply following at a distance. It could be very much a devoted follower, like a fan or someone committed to doing what Jesus says to do. It's unclear exactly how sincere he is. Now, though this person at this point is not called a disciple, in verse 21, it's implied that he was considered a disciple, where the second person is described as another of the disciples. So he's a disciple. And here the term follower is elastic, but so is the term disciple. What does this mean? Is it just simply someone who's a follower in a general sense, or someone who is really committed? We don't know. So Jesus is probing for information. Furthermore, we don't know this man's motives. If he's a teacher, like a scholar, why does he want to follow Jesus? Has he heard the Sermon on the Mount? Has he heard of Jesus' teaching? And has he been impressed with Jesus' handling of the law? And does he see Jesus as a means of furthering his own education, his own end, his own employment? I can be a better scribe if I hang around Jesus. I'm learning stuff that I hadn't seen before. We don't know his motives. Jesus just cuts through the fog. Again, they're on their way to the boats. He says this, "Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." And here, what Jesus is saying here is really quite simple. The creatures of the natural order have their places to live. If a fox wants to escape a predator or needs relief from the heat, they have a hole they can go into in the ground, and they're secure, they're safe, they're protected. The birds of the air have nests in the trees. They raise their young there. They're hidden from predators on the ground. Predators can't reach them. They're safe. But here the Son of Man is nowhere to lay his head. And what Jesus is saying here is, look, I don't own a home. I don't own anything except the clothes on my back and the sandals on my feet. Are you sure you want to follow me? Do you know what you're signing up when you say you want to follow me and be my disciple? The life that I'm going to live is a rigorous life. There will be deprivation. There will be hardship. There will be rejection. Are you sure this is what you want to do? We don't have any record of the man's response, but surely he must have been surprised at what Jesus said to him. And here, one writer says what the scribe is actually doing is presenting himself to Jesus as a volunteer. I'll volunteer to follow you. I'll volunteer to talk about you. I'll volunteer to tell others about you or spread the word about what you're doing. Kind of the way people volunteer for political campaigns. A volunteer can be as committed as someone who is willing to put a flag or a sign in their yard and nothing more. But they can be really much more committed than that. And we don't know exactly where this man is, but he does not appear to be anywhere close to being a serious disciple. Jesus is calling us to be disciples, not volunteers who serve at will when it's convenient, when we like it, when the winds of culture are blowing in our favor. No, he wants disciples who will follow him through thick and through thin. This ties into even the modern time in which we live, where so many people are on social media and they judge their importance by how many followers they have. How many people are clicking in and looking at their account or reading what they're writing or watching their videos or whatever. They view themselves as important if they have more followers than the next person or so-and-so. Or they've increased the number of followers from this time last year by a certain percentage. It's kind of humorous when people describe themselves as influencers. And I'm like, well, what exactly is an influencer? What are your credentials here? What are you really doing in this world except posting stuff on the internet and getting clicks and gathering followers? That's not what Jesus is interested in at all. If Jesus were on earth today, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have social media accounts. He wouldn't be looking at how many followers do we have, how many people tweeted this and retweeted it and posted it. Did it go viral or not? He would really be against that sort of thing because that's shallow, that's cheap. Those people aren't disciples. They're fans, they're followers, they're people who are just as likely to turn away if they find something better. That's not what a disciple is. A disciple will leave it all to follow Jesus. Now there's a second exhibit here, another disciple in verses 21 and 22. This person said to Jesus, maybe on the heels of the scribe, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. What's implicit here is, Lord, I will follow you, but first let me go take care of affairs at home. I need to go bury my father. Well, how are we to understand this man's terminology, I need to go bury my father? The fact of the matter is, if the man's father was dead, he wouldn't be standing before Jesus. Jewish law required that the person who died be buried on the very same day. Jewish law further stipulated that if there is a death of a close relative, that basically the demands of the Torah have all been suspended. You don't have to recite the Shema. You don't have to recite the benedictions. You don't have to do this. You don't have to do that. You go and be with your family and you make sure that your family is cared for in the loss of this loved one. Surely option one isn't on the table. Secondly, this man could be basically saying, look, my father is elderly. He's going to die one of these days. I need to take care of those affairs before I can follow you. In other words, I'm willing to follow you, but let's postpone it for a while. It could be several years. It's not sincere at all about following Jesus at all. Jesus' response is terse. It's almost rude. He said, follow me. Leave the dead to bury their own dead. And here the words follow me are clearly in the imperative form. A clear command. Do this. Keep following me. It's in the present tense. Do not even let family obligations stand in the way of following me. Nothing is to stand in the way of following me. Leave the dead to bury their dead. He's basically saying, look, let this, those who are spiritually dead worry about those who are physically dead. You come and follow me. Don't let family get in the way. Don't allow the culture, and in Judaism, family would be given priority over faith. Don't even allow that to stand in the way of following me. And we might ask ourselves, what is Jesus doing here? Why is he so rude? Why is he so terse with this man? Well, I think there's a shock value in his words. He's shocking us, trying to awaken us that nothing is to come between us and God, not even family. If God calls us to follow him, then we're to follow. No ifs, ands, or buts. Though I've told the story, I'll tell the story again. There was a time, a year or so after my conversion, where I came to a fork in the road with my own family, and my parents gave me an ultimatum. Leave the parachurch organization you're involved with on campus, return to our tradition, or forfeit any help that we are going to give you for your college education. I had to gulp. I had to think it through. I was reminded of this passage, and I said, well, I'm sorry, but I can't follow through with what you're saying. And at that point, they were paying half of what it took to go to college. And so the rest of that was on my own. But the point here is not to somehow draw attention to me as much as just simply to illustrate that in the real world, sometimes we have to do this. We have to put family second in order to follow God. But other things can intrude on following Jesus as well. J.C. Ryle once wrote this about what distracts the people of God from following God. It is not open sin or open unbelief which robs Christ of his professing servants so much as the love of the world, the fear of the world, the cares of the world, the business of the world, the money of the world, the pleasures of the world, and the desire to keep in touch with the world. This is the great rock on which thousands of young people are continually making shipwreck. They do not object to any article of the Christian faith. They do not deliberately choose evil and openly rebel against God. They hope somehow to get into heaven at last, and they think it proper to have some religion, but they cannot give up their idol. They must have the world. He ends and he says, they begin with Abraham and Moses. In other words, they make a good start in the Christian life. But somewhere along the way, they put that aside and they end up with Demas and Lot's wife. Demas, of course, was a companion of Paul, who abandoned Paul because he loved the things of this world. Lot's wife looked back because she was concerned about the things of this world. And what Jesus is saying is nothing should stand in the way of us in following God. Not family, not money, not pleasure, not the things of this world, nothing. Not a relationship, nothing. So ask yourself, are you a follower, a mere follower, or are you truly a disciple? Truly going to follow Jesus and do what he says, regardless of whether it's popular or not. Let's take a moment and spend the rest of our time looking at this phrase that we see in verse 20, the Son of Man, where Jesus refers to the Son of Man having nowhere to lay his head. What does this term mean? Where does it come from? Why does Jesus use it? First of all, the term the Son of Man is a term that's used 80 times in the New Testament. And 77 of those times, it is on the lips of Jesus. He uses it to describe himself. It's his favorite way of referring to himself. Of the three other instances where the term is used, two of those are people quoting Jesus using this phrase. So it's almost exclusively used by Jesus to describe himself. What does the term mean? In the broadest sense, the Son of Man refers to Jesus as a human being. He's a part of humanity, a member of the human race. But this is a title, you will note. It is capitalized. I don't know exactly. I don't recall how it shows up in the Greek. They don't use capital lettering in the Koine system, but it's understood that this is a title. So it means more than just simply a member of humanity. Six times in Matthew's gospel, this refers to Jesus' earthly ministry of coming into this world, obeying the law, of suffering on the cross, of dying, being buried, and rising through the resurrection. There's a third broad meaning to the term. It's an apocalyptic meaning. Meaning refers to something related to the end times. 14 times in Matthew's gospel, this term is used by Jesus related to his future glory or the final judgment and the Son of Man who presides over the final judgment. The term itself actually comes from the Old Testament. Comes from Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14, where we read about one like a son of man appearing before the Ancient of Days who receives world dominion and worship. So it's an Old Testament term, one like a son of man appearing before the Ancient of Days. That kind of explains the what part of this, and we've already kind of touched on where it's used, the term is used, but the real answer or the real question is why? Why does Jesus use the term? Well, in a nation that was charged up over the Romans that were occupying them, and there were people that were wanting to overthrow the Romans, the term Son of Man had no political overtones at all. It was politically neutral. So you couldn't put Jesus in this box. He's aligned with this group or that group, the zealots or whatever it was. So it was kind of like, we don't know how to classify this person or this term that he's using related to himself. It has no political attachments. Yet the term had divine overtones, the Son of Man. People familiar with the Old Testament might have been able to recall this from the book of Daniel, but it wasn't a clear claim to divinity. And so it was kind of mystifying to those who were thinking along divine lines. The term also speaks about redeemed people, that the Son of Man has come to redeem people from the plight in which they find themselves. It also speaks of his humanity, that he has entered into our weakness, and through his suffering has entered into the plight of what it means to be a sinner, a human, living in a fallen world. But all of this doesn't really fully answer why did Jesus use the term. I think D.A. Carson is perhaps the closest when he says this. The simplest answer as to why Jesus used the term is precisely because it was ambiguous. It could conceal as well as reveal. To be ambiguous is that it means has more than one meaning, or could have more than one meaning. Here is Jesus using a term to which people could attach different meanings. He's using it to conceal, he's using it to reveal. To those who are hostile to him, who don't want to believe, who are demanding miracles and signs, and that Jesus, in order to prove something, must jump through certain hoops, the term of Son of Man conceals his true identity. It has some divine overtones, but it's not a clear claim to divinity, so they can't get him on blasphemy. He speaks, he's answering clearly, but it's as if his answer and his identity is still shrouded in mystery. But the term Son of Man reveals when he sits down with his disciples and he talks about them in private, and he talks about what's going to come. They begin to understand that he is God, that he is divine, that a day is coming when he will sit on the great throne and judge and separate the sheep from the goats. A day is coming when he will reign and rule all the peoples of this world. And so when in those private settings, when he talks about the Son of Man, all of a sudden, the eyes of the disciples begin to open up and realize that Jesus isn't just a teacher. He's not just a good orator. He's not just a wonder worker. but that he is divine, that he is our maker and our creator. He is the judge of heaven and earth. And so as you read this term, the Son of Man, particularly in Matthew's Gospel, but it's elsewhere in the New Testament, this gives us great insight into how he understood himself, but also how he used this term to conceal his identity from his enemies, but then to reveal his identity to those who were believers. And so for us, as we consider this term, I think it reveals a lot about Jesus. It's, if you want to do a study and you want to dig into this, and you want to learn more about Jesus, just follow where this Son of Man language takes you. It'll open up all sorts of vistas for you, particularly related to the person and the work of Jesus. But it'll open up more of an understanding and a personal love and devotion towards the Lord Jesus Christ, and understanding who he is and what he has come to do. Let me close with these words, taken from the New Testament. According to Philippians chapter 2, one day every knee on earth will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. And the question that confronts everybody, the people in this account, the people that are sitting here today, all of us and everyone around the world, is this. One day all of us are going to bow before Jesus, and we will confess. We will bow either in grateful adoration, or we will bow in bitter defeat, being crushed by Jesus. The choice is yours. Followers like these two men, if they never place their faith in Jesus, are going to be defeated. And they will bend the knee unwillingly, but they will be forced to bend the knee and confess that Jesus is Lord. But those of us who are disciples, when we see him, we will bend the knee willingly, gratefully, because we truly understand him to be Lord. The choice is yours. So go back and look through these verses and ask yourself, am I sincere about following Jesus? Am I willing to obey him, even if it means going against the culture or going against family? Jesus is not looking for followers, he's looking for disciples. Let's close with prayer. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for this passage, the clear teaching of our Lord.